Love and Light. This is Healthy Talk Show for Monday, April 8th, 2019. I'm Robert.
And I'm Marissa.
Healthy Talk Show streams live on Mondays at 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. That's 3 a.m. UTC over at healthytalkshow.com/live with podcast versions available soon after over at healthytalkshow.com/subscribe. Subscribe to our YouTube channel over at healthytalkshow.com/YouTube.
And healthytalkshow.com/support if you'd like to help support this show financially using PayPal or Patreon. It's value for value. If we provide you value, please provide some back in whatever form you feel. And yes, feedback is valuable. Rate us on iTunes, email us, or call and leave us a voicemail, 509-878-3229. Or email us, ask@healthytalkshow.com.
Correct. Show notes for this episode, the links of everything we talk about, are located at healthytalkshow.com/HTS15. Show housekeeping. We are shortening the episodes down for YouTube. So the podcast is going to stay long, but the YouTube segments are going to be broken up into, you know, different areas of technology and other things.
Yeah.
Today we have fluoride, so we're going to talk about fluoride. That'll be a segment on YouTube by itself with the long format as well. We're trying to get some exposure on YouTube. I think people just don't like watching long stuff on YouTube unless they already know the person kind of thing.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yep.
And other show housekeeping?
Yep, Amazon Prime and Twitch. If you have Amazon Prime, you can give us free money. You link your Amazon Prime account to your Twitch account. And then you can give us a free $2.50 a month if you subscribe to our channel. It's free for you, free for everybody. It's included with Amazon Prime. It just takes a few minutes out of your month because you have to do it every month. You can't do it. It doesn't auto-renew. Don't know why. Trying to keep us down. Keep the small streamers down. Anything else? Want to get into the show?
Unless you wanted to mention we consolidated to one computer.
Yes, we did. That's another show housekeeping thing. We did consolidate to one computer. Right now, we are running everything on my computer. We're going to see if we can run it.
Hopefully, everything goes well. I feel a little weird not running the audio today.
I know. Hopefully, I have pressed record. Let me go back and check the audio. It's the red button's on, so that means it's recording.
Yeah, that's good.
And okay. Okay, let's get to the show.
Let's do it.
All right, Bloomberg. This school doesn't care who your parents are. The faculty and alumni have won 39 Nobel Prizes. Graduates include former Compaq chairman Ben Rosen and Intel co-founder Gordon Moore, known for the law, the computer processing doubles every 2 years. Moore's law. Is it Stanford, Harvard, or MIT? No, it's the California Institute of Technology, a school with fewer than 1,000 undergraduates in Pasadena, California. As parents caught up in the college corruption scandal head to court, 128-year-old Caltech provides a counterpoint to the perception that money and connections can rig admissions. Selection criteria are based on the highest standards of academic excellence, a spokeswoman said in an email. The typical student has an SAT math score of 790 to 800, which represents a perfect result. The school selects for students whose prior pursuing demonstrates a passion for science. Caltech gives no preference to the applications of alumni kids or legacies. That makes it a rarity among elite colleges. Its close cousin, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, has the same policy. So, Marissa, what do you know about Caltech?
Huh. Not really sure, but it sounds like a great school.
It sounds like a really good school.
Uh-oh.
What?
I doubled for a second in the audio.
Did you?
And now it stopped.
Uh-oh. You heard yourself twice?
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Are we going to keep going?
Yeah, let's just keep going for now.
Keep going.
Yeah, I think that's really refreshing to hear after all these scandals.
Yeah.
And I think the article said it's such a hard school, you probably wouldn't want to cheat your way into it.
Correct. I hear it's very brutal from people.
That's what I hear too.
Yeah. I hear it's a good school.
Yeah.
People should go there. I heard only smart people go there.
That's what
I don't
I
know
hear.
If it's true or not, but
yeah.
Don't know.
All right.
CNBC, Tesla cars keep more data than you think, including this video of a crash that totaled a Model 3. We have the video we'll show you in a second. A white hat hacker calling himself Green the Only has extracted this kind of data from the computers in various models of Teslas, while also making tens of thousands of dollars cashing in on Tesla bug bounties in recent years. Many other cars download and store data from users, particularly information from paired cell phones such as contact information. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission, FTC, has issued advisories to drivers warning them about pairing devices to rental cars and urging them to learn how to wipe their car's system clean before returning a rental or selling a car that they owned. Teslas that are sent to salvage can yield unencrypted and personally revealing data to anyone who takes possession of the car's computer and knows how to extract it. This video, extracted from a wrecked Model 3, shows the car spinning out of the right lane into the trees, left side. Let's actually just show the video.
Yeah, let's show.
Showing the video. Boop, boop. Here's the video. This is extracted from a Tesla.
That's crazy. A crashed
Tesla. That's pretty darn good quality video.
Yeah.
That's great. Look at that. Oh, painful.
Oh, my gosh.
That's really good quality, considering a lot of people don't know the car's recording you.
Yeah. And then while that, so what else did it show?
That video? What?
Oh, no. What other data was he able to get?
Call logs that show the iPhone present in the car at the time of the crash belonged to a relative of the founder and chairman of the company that owned the Model 3. Moments before the vehicle crashed, researchers found incoming call logs indicated that a family member had called the driver of the Model 3. Another video stored on the car showed an earlier accident where the Model 3 sideswiped a guardrail.
Jeez.
Woo! There's a lot of personal information.
I thought the Tesla was supposed to drive for you.
Well, not that one.
And he has distracted driving or?
Not that one.
Yeah, I was really shocked because the article said that they had data stored from 17 different devices and this was unencrypted. They showed how often phones or tablets have paired to the car. They said 170 times and held 11 phone books worth of contact information.
11 phone books worth.
That's crazy.
But, you know, it does mention the rental cars. A lot of people get these nice rental cars. They sync their phones, all their contacts, text, presumably a lot of other things, and the next person that drives the car.
Yeah.
Have access to all that information. Moving on. The Verge. Facebook app developers leaked millions of user records on cloud servers, researchers say. 540 million user records, to be exact, or according to that. Facebook app developers left hundreds of millions of users' records exposed on a publicly visible cloud server, or servers, researchers from security firm UpGuard reported. Two data sets came in from a Mexican media company called Cultura Colectiva, a 146 gigabyte set with information like Facebook user activity, account names, and IDs was found that included more than 540 records, of course. A similar data set was also found for an app called At the Pool. While smaller, the latter included especially personal information, including 22,000 passwords apparently used for the app rather than directly for Facebook.
Jeez.
Yes, and moving right along with Facebook news, Ars Technica, Facebook asked some users for their email passwords, because why not? This is interesting. The Daily Beast reported on April 2nd, some new Facebook users were being asked to provide both their email address and their email password in order to register accounts. The email password practice was first noticed by a software developer and information security expert who goes by the handle eSushi. Hey Facebook, his tweet said, at Facebook, demanding the secret password of personal email accounts of your users for verification or any kind of use is a horrible idea from an InfoSec point of view. By going down that road, you're practically phishing for passwords. You're not supposed to know. And I have a picture. Sorry. There you go. And that's a picture of them asking, to continue using Facebook, you'll need to confirm your email address. Because you signed up with blank at gmx.net, you need to do this on X, blah, 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 your email password. Why does Facebook need to know your email password?
Yeah. What's it doing?
What?
Course, I like how they say, oh, we don't store them.
Yeah, in the response,
yeah.
Facebook spokesperson said email passwords are not stored by Facebook and also said that the company was ending the practice of requesting. What?
Why did you even start the practice,
Why
though?
Would that be a practice? Facebook.
Doesn't make any sense.
Shame, shame. All right, NPR, we have some clips on this one. Housing department slaps Facebook with discrimination charge. Let's take a look or a listen.
HUD says it is charging Facebook with violating the Fair Housing Act over the way that it allowed advertisers to target and exclude some users. We should note before going on that Facebook is one of NPR's financial supporters.
I left that in there on purpose.
We are nevertheless reporting independently on it, and NPR's Bracton Booker is here. Bracton, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
According to HUD, how does Facebook discriminate?
Well, as you said in the intro there, HUD is saying that Facebook violated the Fair Housing Act, and that, of course, is a federal protection that was established in 1968. It protects homebuyers and renters from being discriminated against on the basis of race and religion and other protected classes.
Yep, that's true. Second clip, what's going on?
Now, HUD is saying that Facebook allows advertisers to shield who can see which ads appear on their platform on the basis of race.
Do you mean that if an advertiser only wanted white people to see an apartment ad, just to give a hypothetical, that Facebook would allow that to happen?
Yes, there are certain
demographic, I think.
Yeah.
When you're an advertiser, you pay for demographic, but
things that advertisers can click on the platform that allow certain people to see. So if they are, if a Facebook user kind of identifies as a African American dog lover, and Facebook only wants to appear to, say, an Anglo cat lover, they can select different things on the platform that allows, that shields certain people from seeing certain ads.
Interesting. Facebook being slammed by HUD for discrimination under fair housing.
So what are they going to do to targeted advertising?
Well, I don't know, but I got a better question. How does Facebook know race?
People, because of course the platform asks for your name, asks for your phone number, asks for your birthday, a lot of other things. I don't know if they directly ask for race, but they must get it from somewhere.
Well, HUD is saying in their charging document that Facebook mines extensive data about users and uses that data to determine which...
Mines data because apparently it doesn't even ask for your race. I don't know. I'm not that in on Facebook. So they're mining data to find...
Surprise.
Users can see housing-related ads. So in theory, because of things that you like and things that you share, there are some kind of algorithms that allow advertisers and Facebooks to know kind of who these people are.
And just reaffirming, it's really the advertisers?
Well, it's really the advertisers. So it's the
advertisers. Facebook allows
advertisers, when they want to create an ad, when they're trying to look for the perfect tenant or the perfect home buyer, they can start to select certain characteristics to make sure that, you know, the people that are seeing these ads are kind of the target audience that they want.
And the excluded person doesn't even know they're being excluded.
They don't know. They
don't
know.
They never see the ad. They never see the available.
Now, I went into this just a little bit, just in the legal document, and I just pulled some things, but I'm not going to show you. I actually put it over on my other screen, so, you know, just so you know, there is a legal document here. They did write something. HUD doesn't have money. So, honestly, I don't understand where they're getting this money from. Ooh, our stream just took a big wipe. That's okay. They're running out of money. It's okay. But part C, factual allegations. Again, not... But Facebook is different. People on Facebook share their true identities, interests, life events, and more. As Respondent explains, its advertising platform enables advertisers to reach people based on zip codes, age, and gender, specific languages, the interests they've shared, their activities, the pages they've liked, their purchase behaviors or intents, device usage, and more. Thus, Respondent uses a location-related information such as your current location, where you live, the place you like to go, and the businesses and people you're near to provide personalized and improve our products, including ads for you and others. Conclusion, among other legal BS. There's a lot of conclusions in here. Requires respondents, agents, and employees to attend and respondents cost training that addresses the Fair Housing Act's prohibitions against discrimination in advertising. Awards such damages pursuant to 42 USC, blah, 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 as will fully compensate any aggrieved person for any harm caused by respondents' discriminatory contact. Awards a maximum civil penalty against the respondent for each violation of the act pursuant to 42 USC, section 36, whatever it means, a bunch of legalese stuff. Woo! Lot to read. I don't think anything's going to come of it.
I mean, it's just funny because if they were not allowed to do targeted advertising,
they wouldn't have a business.
Yeah. So
the whole point of targeted ads is that they're discriminatory and they discriminate. That's the point. You're an advertiser and you want your ads to hit somebody. Well, there you go. But we have more stories about advertising later. You ready?
Yeah.
Ars Technica, teenager hit with 73 counts for swatting call. An Ohio teen has been charged with 40 felonies and 33 misdemeanors after a multi-state investigation revealed that he had placed dozens of hoax emergency calls in a practice known as swatting. Swatting, the action or practice of making a prank call to emergency services in an attempt to bring about the dispatch of a large number of armed police officers to a particular address. The investigation was triggered by an August call to a sheriff's department in Putnam County, New York. A caller claimed he had shot his wife and was holding his son hostage with an AR-15. Thankfully, that turned out to be a lie. The house was unoccupied. The police were able to check the story without anyone getting hurt. People get hurt in these. Investigators were able to get information about the phone used to make the fake emergency call. They also learned that there were similar incidents in other jurisdictions around the United States, a Putnam County press release states. Now, swatting is bad.
Please don't swat.
People do it online. Yeah, people do it to streamers all the time. Imagine us doing our show live, and then the SWAT team shows up and shoots us. Because usually someone ends up getting shot.
Yeah.
Someone gets shot in these instances all the time. Because I go answer the door, I'm, what the hell? And then shoot me. Happens. Sometimes.
That's terrible.
It is. Because the police are all amped up. They think they got a terrorist hostage situation. Yeah. They're all ready to rock and roll. And it's just two nerds, you know, on their computers playing video games.
Yeah, it's really horrible, though.
Yeah, it really is. But, hey, if the kid didn't do it, day in court. Also, where are the parents? Okay. That was the break. See? Did it break? You ready?
Yeah.
USA Today. After thousands of cats died in experiments, USA Today. After thousands of cats died in experiments, USDA says it will stop controversial research program. The USDA said its Agricultural Research Service's toxoplasmosis research has been redirected, and cats will no longer be part of any of the lab's protocol. Toxoplasmosis is a disease linked to foodborne illness and deaths in the U.S. The agency says its research has reduced the prevalence of Toxoplasma gondii, the parasite, as much as 50% in our nation. Which is funny, because we just talked about this last week, and they were saying that they needed it.
Yeah.
Because it was just, it's the only way to get this research done, and to get this parasite, to beat the parasite. So
I still want to know what kind of research was being conducted.
Yeah, because now I'm skeptical, because you said it was required and essential, and now, sorry, we're not going to do it anymore, it's good. So wait, was it essential? Or were you just killing cats for
now,
the fun of
it? Now I'm just confused, because you needed the cats to produce the oocytes.
Yep. So how are you producing the oocytes, man? That's the question.
I don't know. The feline is the only animal that it completes the whole life cycle, so.
I'm questioning.
Questioning everything.
Question more. That's RTs. Russians. Time. Cats respond to the sound of their names, study says. Whether they care is another question. Okay. Atsuko Saito of Sophia University of Tokyo says there's no evidence cats actually attach meaning to our words, not even their own names. Instead, they've learned that when they hear their names, they often get rewards like food or play, or sometimes bad like a trip to the vet. Ooh. And they hear their names a lot. So the sound of it becomes special, even if they don't really understand it refers to their identity. In four experiments with 16 to 34 animals, each cat heard a recording of its owner's voice or another person's voice that slowly recited a list of four nouns and other cats' names, followed by the cat's own name. Many cats initially reacted, such as by moving their heads, ears, or tails, but gradually lost interest as the words were read. The crucial question was whether they'd respond to their name.
You can flip over to my screen.
Sure enough, on average, these cats perked up when they heard their own name. Bam, go.
Oh, I was just pointing out the graphs that were perked up right there at the end once they heard their name.
Heard their name. What do we think about this?
It was interesting, too, because they also compared this from cats in a cat cafe. So they're not hearing people say their names in the same tone. And the cats in the cat cafe, they don't know their own name as well. And that makes sense because the cat gets used to how the owner says the name.
Yeah.
So it was interesting. I liked it. Tang usually responds to his name.
Good.
He's on strike right now. But
he is.
That's
when he comes
story.
Back, he'll be back.
He knows we're talking about him.
Yep. Inverse. Americans like dogs more than cats for one simple reason. Dog owners spend $240 a month caring for their pets, compared to $193 for cats, according to 2017-2018 National Pet Owner Survey from the American Pet Products Association. The extra money goes primarily toward vet visits and kennel boarding, but dog owners also spend more lavishly on treats, grooming, and toys. Dogs have masters, cats have staff. A new paper by Colleen P. Kirk may shine some light as to why. I have highlights from the paper I'd like to read first. Highlights from the paper: consumers will pay more for... Consumers will pay more for sugary insurance and specialty pet products for dogs than cats. That's true. Valuation differences are due to consumers' feelings of ownership and attachment for dogs versus cats. Perceived control of the pet's behavior drives consumers' feelings in ownership and valuation. These valuation differences are reversed when a dog behaves like a cat and a cat behaves like a dog. Interesting.
Although, if you do notice that article was written by the author
of
this of study.
I did see that.
Like, wow, that's
Colleen P. Kirk. Oh, that's good. Good promotion there. Hey, how do you get a job at Inverse where you can write a post about something you've published?
Yeah.
Think about that. Nothing wrong with that. You got anything on that story? Good?
Oh, You know, I wasn't quite satisfied with the research. Oh,
yeah. Never am. You never are. Never.
You know, they were talking about that dog owners have stronger bonds to their pets, but they didn't really quantify that.
Yeah.
And then one thing they also noted is that dog owners tended to be more rich. And I don't know if they accounted for that exactly.
I would say that dog owners definitely spend more money on their animals than cats. That's pretty safe to say. Cats are low maintenance.
Yeah.
Cats are superior pets, in my opinion.
I mean, but there's a lot of other confounding factors. I feel like most dog owners only own one or two dogs. Most cat owners own...
11?
Yeah. We're only at two. We're just beginning.
Yep. We need 9 more.
So, I don't know.
Talkshow.com/support.
There's still a lot of unaddressed issues. I felt like she made more of an assertion about the fact that dog owners feel more attached, but then didn't really quantify that.
Yeah.
That well. So
it's okay. It's cute. It's a cute study.
It's still cute, but
it is cute. CNN, even one alcoholic drink a day can raise risk of stroke, study says. BBC, even one drink a day can increase stroke risk, study finds. The Lancet, conventional and genetic evidence on alcohol and vascular disease. What's that word? I don't know. A prospective study of 500,000 men and women in China. Contradicting previous claims that moderate drinking could prevent strokes, other diseases, and conditions, the new study published in The Lancet links even low levels of alcohol consumption with increased blood pressure that can lead to strokes. UK and Chinese researchers followed 500,000 Chinese people for 10 years. The researchers found that drinking 1 to 2 alcoholic drinks every day increased stroke risk by 10 to 15%, and drinking 4 drinks every day increased the risk of having a stroke by 35%. For the purposes of their study, one drink was defined as either a small glass of wine, a bottle of beer, a single measured of spirits. The study also found no evidence of light or moderate drinking having a protective effect. In other words, reducing the risk of stroke. This study, what do you think about this study? A lot of alcohol stuff.
Yeah.
Pop up in the weeks here.
I found it funny that they study Chinese people for a very specific reason.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that some of them have, as you probably colloquially will know, Asian flesh.
Mm-hmm.
So they studied the people that had this genetic variability where they're unable to process alcohol.
Yeah.
And because that keeps them from drinking alcohol a lot. Because a lot of these people that have really severe Asian flesh don't drink alcohol
because
it's unpleasant to them. So then they were really able to kind of study these long-term effects as opposed to trying to study people that might have variable alcohol consumption patterns. And so, they really found that it's associated with about an increase of 8% of one type of stroke and a 16% of intracerebral hemorrhages. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And then they also use that genetic effects to figure out the cardiovascular risk as well.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. But of course, it may not be applicable as much to other genetic populations, but still interesting.
Yep. Everything in moderation. That's whenever I'm asked about alcohol, I always say everything in moderation, especially with alcohol.
Yeah.
Moderation. Very little. Science Daily. Berkeley soda tax election changed drinking habits months before prices went up. The analysis revealed that economic inquiry, Soda Wars, the effect of a soda tax election on university beverage sales. The analysis revealed that soda sales dropped an average of 10 to 20% in the 3 months immediately following the vote before the tax and any associated price hikes went into effect. The result indicated the contentious Berkeley versus Big Soda campaign and the ultimate vote in favor of the tax were able to lower soda sales in the city. In this case, an election really worked to change consumption before a price change, said Sophia Villa-Boas, professor of agricultural and resource economics at UC Berkeley and senior author of the paper in the journal Economic Inquiry. A big takeaway from our study is that if you replicate a soda tax or some other similar measure in a different city, you might not witness the same consumption results if you didn't have a campaign and election leading up to the actual tax implementation, said Scott Kaplan, a graduate student and co-author of this paper. Bam. What do you think?
Why don't we just have campaigns then instead of taxes?
And I was, what that made me think of the soda tax, the gas tax here in California that nobody voted for it to be implemented. The government just said, oh, here you go. We're implementing this gas tax. And then we tried to repeal it. And then, of course. Well, it didn't get repealed.
It doesn't help that the wording on that was so convoluted.
Yeah, I know. Vote no to repeal. Or no, vote yes to repeal. So yes
forgot.
Means no, but no means yes. They like to do that.
I forgot.
Inverse. Three common diets are cutting 1 in 5 human life short every year. New York Times, eat your veggies. Study finds poor diets linked to 1 in 5 deaths. The Lancet. Health effects of dietary risk in 195 countries. 1990 to 2017 is systematic analysis for the Global Burden of Disease Study, 2017. An assessment of how and how many people die from disease in countries around the world each year. Funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the authors set out to find just how many deaths and lost years of life could actually be attributed to unhealthy eating habits annually. Poor diet can mean a lot of things, but the study allowed the authors to boil it down to 3 major inadequacies. Too much salt, not enough whole grains, and not enough fruit. In 2017, high intake of sodium was responsible for 3 million deaths worldwide. Low intake of whole grains also led to 3 million deaths, and low intake of fruits led to 2 million deaths. Other issues included diets that didn't have enough nuts and seeds, vegetables, omega-3s from seafood, or fiber, along with many other components. In 2017, more than half of diet-related deaths and 2/3 of diet-related disability-adjusted life years were attributed to high intake of sodium, the team writes. Sodium was a top risk factor for East Asian countries like China, Japan, Indonesia, and Thailand, nations whose cuisine is heavily reliant on salty sauces and pastes.
I don't know how the U.S. didn't get mentioned for our love of fast food, salty fast food.
Yeah, we do have a lot of salty
fast food. That's the problem with eating out is you consume way more sodium than you realize.
Yes, especially at Applebee's. Their sodium really? Is off. Oh my gosh, their food's so salty. Ugh, it's the worst. Yeah. All right, moving on. CNN, the land of immortals. How and what Japan's oldest population eats. And there's a video and yeah.
People talk about longevity genes. What I now know is that we probably all have these longevity genes. The genes need to be activated. It's kind of like saying, you know, we have the blueprint of the house. We all have the same blueprint of the house, but now we're going to start laying in the raw materials and building the actual house itself. In this case, the genes that you have are the blueprint, and the raw ingredients are certain foods. And you find that in Japan, the sort of staple diet tends to activate these genes. There's a reason why foods like bitter melon have been preserved and passed down for generations in a place like Japan. They intuitively knew that this food was somehow good for you.
Interesting. Pretty cool. Dr. Sanjay Gupta, I think. Got a follow-up.
They call her Umeto-san. She's nearly 100 years old. She's 97. The way that she moves, the pace at which she walks, the smile, the energy she has. She said that her heart felt like she was 20 years old. No evidence of disease whatsoever, and a really, really healthy outlook on life.
What are we having for dinner?
Goya champuru. Goya.
I think the secret in Okinawa, where people are more likely to live to 100 than many other places around the world, is the way that they eat.
Can you put your hands like this? It's amazing. I probably have more of a tremor than she does.
The way that they approach aging overall, the elderly are revered, their wisdom is solicited, they seem to have more purpose in life. And then obviously someone like Umeto-san, she has this incredible tight social circle and these activities like dancing and singing, which definitely keep her younger at heart.
If you ask anyone in Okinawa why they live so long, you will doubtlessly hear two words, aikigi and moai. Aikigi, loosely translated, means sense of purpose in life, a person's aikigi. Aikigi often grows as they get older. It is the reason for living, that thing that propels them in out of bed in the morning. In the United States, people often retire in their mid-60s, but there isn't a similar word in Japanese because the concept of retirement doesn't even exist. Moai is an informal social group of people who have common interests and look out for each other. Your moai is your tribe, and another reason Okinawans believe they live so long. Haruhichibu, translation, stop eating when you are 80% full. With Haruhichibu, the philosophy is that you should still be a little hungry when you push the plate away. Okinawans typically eat 7 different fruits and vegetables and 18 different foods a day, and more than 200 different foods and spices regularly in their overall diet. In the United States, we are lucky to consume a dozen fruits and vegetables. Excuse me, a dozen different foods in our regular daily diet total.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yes. She looked great.
Oh, she moved.
That's really important, I think, about finding your tribe, trying to build your community.
Yep. I agree. 100%. It's just social circles. It is what it is. And we keep saying that social circles, these are all really important. We're losing sight of that with the phones and technology and all these social bull BS.
Oh, yeah. There were some other interesting things. One thing they did mention was the bento box style of eating.
Yes.
So small portions, lots of different fruits, things. Vegetables.
Yes.
Yeah. And then one thing that really caught me, though, is the elderly there are still widely revered, but there are fewer of them, and they are less often living to 100 than in decades past. Still, the land of immortals reminds us of what is possible, whether you live in Okinawa or anywhere else in the world. I thought that was kind of interesting that less of them are living to 100, even, you know, in this more modern age. So it's kind of suggesting that our habits are becoming unhealthier.
Yeah.
And we need to just go back to living simply, mm-hmm. you know, enjoying one another's company. Having a good diet.
Because I have a friend who's from a small Mexican village, and people there live until 90 to 100 easy.
Well, it's probably the same thing.
Yeah.
They keep active. They're mm-hmm. riding horses every day. That's all very important.
Very interesting.
And just like...
We're corrupting our bodies, our minds, our souls. We're corrupting everything.
We got to feed our bodies good food, medicine, not medicate later.
Yes. Not related. Or maybe it is. CNN, about 1 in 4 Japanese adults in their 20s and 30s are virgins, study says. Public health experts at the University of Tokyo found that sexual inexperience was on the rise in the country, with the percentage of women aged 18 to 39 who've never had sex rising to 24.6% in 2015 from 21.7% in 1992. The change was greater for men of the same age, with 25.8% virgins in 2015, up from 20% in 1992. By comparison, surveys from the UK and the United States and Australia suggest that rates of heterosexual inexperience are between 1% to 5% of adults and are about their 30s. The researchers based their nationwide estimate on data from 7 national fertility studies conducted over 3 decades. Each drew on the responses of between 11,553 and 17,859 adults, ages 18 to 39.
Very interesting.
I just wanted to, that popped up today, and I said, I have got to throw that in there.
You That's know, did it say why?
I actually don't know. Here's the study if you want to read it.
I'll have to look at
it's it. It's just, it's, yeah, I read the conclusions, but didn't actually say, why.
So if anyone's looking for a virgin, go to Japan.
Well, I would love to go to Japan, though. I will say that. I've always wanted to visit.
Yeah, now you'll really want to.
Do they have Tinder in Japan from the chat room? They sure do. They sure do. Science Daily, just an hour of weekly walking staves off disability. Just 1 hour a week of brisk walking, as if you're late to an appointment or trying to make a train, staves off disability in older adults with arthritis pain or aching or stiffness in a knee, hip, ankle, or foot, reports a new Northwestern Medicine study. This is less than 10 minutes a day for people to maintain their independence. It's very doable, said lead author Dorothy Dunlap, professor of preventative medicine at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. This minimum threshold may motivate inactive adults to begin their path toward a physically active lifestyle with the wide range of health benefits promoted by physical activity. Study investigators analyzed 4 years of data for more than 1,500 adults in the National Osteoarthritis Initiative from Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Columbus, and Pawtucket, Rhode Island. These adults all had pain, aching, or stiffness in lower extremity joints from osteoarthritis, but were free of disability when they began the study. Their physical activity was monitored using accelerometers. The study found an hour of weekly moderate to vigorous physical activity allowed older adults to maintain their ability to perform daily tasks like getting dressed or cross a street before a traffic light walk signal changed. The weekly hour of exercise reduced the risk of mobility disability, walking too slowly to safely cross a street or less than 1 meter per second by 85%, and their risk of activities of daily living disability, difficulty performing morning routine tasks such as walking across a room, bathing, and dressing by almost 45%. Walk more.
Yeah.
Moral of the story.
Just and another moral of the story, small changes every day. Consistency is key.
Small changes.
Also, I need to pick up my walking pace, apparently.
Yes.
I walk slow.
You walk a little slow. You also have very short legs. CNN, mystery E. coli outbreak sickened 72 people in 5 states, CDC says. 8 people involved in the mysterious outbreak have been hospitalized. No deaths have been reported. People started becoming ill March 2nd, and patients range in age from 1 to 74. Additional illnesses tied to this outbreak may still be reported, the CDC said. States reporting sick patients are Georgia with 8 patients, Kentucky 36, Ohio 5, Tennessee 21, and Virginia 2. Government scientists have not identified a food item, grocery store, or restaurant chain as a source of these infections. The CDC, state health departments, and U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food Safety and Inspection Services and U.S. Food and Drug Administration are investigating the outbreak. To prevent exposure, CDC recommends washing your hands regularly, especially after using a restroom, changing diapers, and before and after preparing or eating food, cooking meats thoroughly to kill harmful germs, cook steaks and roast to at least 145 degrees and let rest for 3 minutes after you remove the meat from the grill or stove, washing fruits and vegetables before eating, unless the package says the contents have been washed, still wash them, refraining from preparing food or drink for others when you are sick. Good information. Yeah. We actually have a little thing from the Mayo Clinic on E. coli, just real quick, because who knows everything about E. coli? I don't know. We'll see.
E. coli can spread through contaminated food. Common culprits include undercooked ground beef and raw vegetables like lettuce and spinach.
E. coli is a very common bacteria, so most of the time E. coli doesn't cause any kind of problem at all. There are certain strains of E. coli that can cause problems.
Those problems include diarrhea, abdominal pain, and nausea. People with severe symptoms are at risk for kidney failure.
E. coli can affect anyone exposed to the bacteria, but younger children and older adults are at a higher risk for problems, as are people with weakened immune systems.
The body's pretty smart.
Dr. Claypool says in most cases, treatment is simply rest and fluids, but
when it doesn't go away or you're having nausea and vomiting or diarrhea to the point you're starting to feel weak or dizzy or dehydrated, then you need to be seen.
Meantime, the best way to avoid E. coli is to wash your hands and your food and thoroughly cook that burger.
That's what I said. Thanks, Mayo Clinic. That was a great video.
We'll see what the culprit is. I'm sure they'll eventually come out that it was some leafy green or something.
Yeah.
It usually is, but...
That's the way it is.
Just try to wash your leafy greens well. Hey, some people even use soap.
Yeah, they do. Use a little drop of soap.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah.
Get it really clean.
That's true. Science Daily. Researchers engineer a cost-effective treatment for neglected tropical disease. Researchers have turned a fungus into a disease-curing factory through a modern genetic engineering and patience. The natural antibiotic is a promising cure for a neglected tropical disease called human African trypanosomiasis, or African sleeping sickness. That's how I'm going to refer to it. That infects thousands of people in remote rural areas in sub-Saharan Africa each year. I actually have background on that sleeping sickness, but let's finish with this. The fungus Acromonium aegypticum naturally produces two different types of antibiotic. One is toxic to humans, but the other was identified as a potential treatment for African sleeping sickness in 1996. Artificially synthesizing the antibiotic would not be cost-effective, and the more common method of using bacteria to produce the chemical is infeasible. The research team identified that the fungus's two antibiotics are both made from the same precursor molecule. After the precursor is created, two separate groups of enzymes produce the two different antibiotics. Researchers can leave the precursor molecule and the genes responsible for the desired antibiotic completely unchanged by simply deleting the genes responsible for the other toxic antibiotic. In every liter of fungus that researchers grow in the lab, the engineered strain of fungus can produce 500 milligrams of antibiotic. The desired antibiotic is acofuranin. It is also a candidate to treat cancer somehow.
I think it's ascofuranone.
Yeah, there you go. Ascofuranone. There you go. Would you like to learn about African sleeping sickness?
Yeah.
I have a video on it. Let's take a look.
Human African trypanosomiasis, also known as sleeping sickness, is a disease caused by a group of parasites called Trypanosoma brucei. The two main types causing human disease are Trypanosoma brucei gambiense and rhodesiense. There are other types of Trypanosoma brucei which cause animal disease and very occasionally infect humans. Chagas disease, also known as American trypanosomiasis, is a different disease caused by Trypanosoma cruzi. Gambiense is the most common form of African trypanosomiasis, accounting for about 97% of all cases. It's found in countries in Central and West Africa and tends to cause the chronic form of disease. Rhodesiense accounts for about 3% of cases. It's found in countries in Eastern and Southern Africa and causes a more acute infection. Although there were about 300,000 estimated cases in 1995, intense control activities in affected countries have led to a dramatic decline in cases. Good. In 2014, the number of cases was estimated to be about 15,000. Let's have a look at how the disease is transmitted. The parasite is transmitted to humans through the bite of an infected tsetse fly. These flies are only found in sub-Saharan Africa, most commonly in rural areas. Both female and male flies can transmit the infection. These flies tend to bite during daylight hours. Flies can get infected when they bite a person or animal infected with the parasite. Domestic and wild animals can carry the parasite and are important reservoirs of infection, especially for Rhodesiense. Humans are the main reservoir for Gambiense. Very uncommonly, the infection can be transmitted from mother to baby or through blood transfusions, infected needles and syringes, or sexually.
Ooh. Sounds bad. Tropical diseases, I believe, is just a fancy term for diseases nobody cares about. I saw that on Joe Rogan. He had a tropical disease vaccine guy.
Oh, yeah.
And he was talking about, basically diseases. There's no profit in it because there's not enough people getting the issue.
Yeah, that's kind of horrible.
We kind of have to do it out of the kindness of our hearts.
Oh, you should flip to my screen real quick.
Hold on. Oh, let's go. We're going to go back to African sleeping sickness, how it presents. Sorry. But it's okay. We're going to go to you first. Bam. Go.
I was going to say, this is the molecule, guys. If anyone wants to synthesize
molecule,
we can make some money. Natural product synthesis. Let's get on it.
There you go. Make some money. HealthyTalkShow.com/support. How does it present itself?
Let's have a look at how the disease presents.
Yeah, it presents.
There are two main stages of the disease. In the first or early stage, the parasite is found outside the central nervous system, mainly in the blood, lymphatic system, or other organs such as the heart, liver, spleen, or eye. In the second or late stage, the parasite invades the central nervous system. Initially, there can be a painful sore, also called a canker, at the site of the tsetse fly bite. Symptoms of the first stage include fever, muscle and joint pain, headaches, itching, and enlarged lymph nodes. It can lead to disease in the affected organs, such as inflammation of the heart muscle, enlargement of the spleen and liver, and eye disease. In the second stage, there can be a range of neurological symptoms, such as changes in personality, psychiatric symptoms, weakness, or problems with movement. The disease can affect sleep. Patients tend to have nighttime sleep disturbances and are sleepy during the day. This can get progressively worse, with patients sleeping most of the time. This is why the disease is called sleeping sickness. If left untreated, the disease can lead to death. The severity of the disease and how quickly the disease progresses from the first stage to the second stage depends on the type of parasite. In Rhodesiense infections, it's quite fast, usually a few weeks. On the other hand, in Gambiense infections, it may take several years. People who get infected may not have symptoms for months, if not years.
Jeez.
When they do, they're usually in the second stage.
Jeez. Brutal.
So no hints, and then bam, you got it. Crap. And in the chat, as far as tropical vaccines, lots of people get diseases and they're all poor. Yeah, that's true too. If there's no money in it, they don't care. That's the whole thing. It's a tropical disease when there's no money to be made. How about that? That's what makes it tropical. Moving on. Where are we at? Ah, yes. This is a good one. Science Daily. Ethical questions raised on body donation after medically assisted death. The legalization of medical assistance in dying made in Canada has resulted in some people choosing to donate their bodies to anatomy programs, but has raised profound ethical issues, says McMaster University's head of anatomy. At this point, it is unclear how many anatomical programs we have accepted or are accepting bodies of persons who end their life using MAID, as no reliable information exists on this topic, says Wayman, a professor of pathology and molecular medicine at McMaster. Right now, the law was passed in right after the law was passed in Canada, the bodies began to arrive, Wayneman said. MAID makes up to 5% of our body donations now, but I can see it easily going to 10% before the end of the year. That makes it 5 to 10 bodies a year. Wayneman said, we find the potential MAID donors are far more likely to want to donate their bodies to science. As a result, we are typically in contact with the donor themselves, who reach out to us to talk about the donation. An ethical question I face is that For these people who are so vulnerable, who are at the moment trying to decide if their life is worth living, are we somehow inducing them to want to donate? Are we providing them with additional impetus to donate? It's a serious issue, as the last thing we want to do is to bring out any pressure at this difficult point in their lives. Very interesting.
I hadn't really thought about that before when, you know, people are talking about medically assisted dying.
And talking to the end, like,
because I've always been a supporter of medically assisted death. I mean, if you have a terminal illness and you know you're going to die, why do you want to continue to suffer?
But if you're talking to the people that are going to end up with your body afterwards, they're saying, yeah, you know, you're going to be a hero. You're going to save the world. I'm going to say, yeah, you know, I'm ready.
But at the same time, I mean, their bodies are going to a good cause. To all those medical students, they have to practice.
Absolutely.
It's a really interesting one. But then this made me think of something else. Because what about organ donation?
Yes. People that I know in conspiratorial circles say do not be an organ donor because they will not revive you. That's what people...
I don't know. It's unconscious possible. Bias, because if anyone sees, oh, they're an organ donor, maybe.
Maybe we don't know.
Maybe we don't try as hard. Sorry, they're dead. I don't know.
A lot of paranoid people I know believe that.
Well, it's hard to tell, too, exactly what the subconscious mind is thinking as well.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yep. I agree. CNN, Americans borrow $88 billion annually to pay for healthcare, survey finds. About 1 in 8 Americans resorted to borrowing to afford healthcare in the previous year, according to a West Health Gallup survey. 65 million adults say they had health issues, but didn't seek treatment due to cost. Nearly a quarter had to cut back on spending to pay for healthcare or medicine. Not only do you have a real significant number that are deferring care, foregoing care altogether, you also have a big chunk that are getting the care but having to borrow to get it, said Diane Witters, Gallup senior researcher. These statistics are the latest examples of how the nation is struggling with the high cost of medical care. The United States spent more than $10,700 per person on health care in 2017, federal data shows. That's more money than any other country. And our healthcare kind of sucks.
Yeah. Well, we don't want to admit what a huge part of the economy relies on the healthcare industry.
Yeah.
So no one wants to cut out all the insurance companies.
Cut out the jobs.
So I don't know how it's going to change until we really have radical overhaul.
Yep. CNN, how men and women use condoms differently. Journal of Sex Research, are we blinded by desire, relationship motivation, and sexual risk-taking intentions during condom negotiation? The safe sex conversation should be a simple one. Who doesn't want to protect themselves against sexually transmitted infections? Yet for many people, it can be an uncomfortable negotiation. Perhaps that's because men and women seem to approach that discussion about condom use from different angles. That's the conclusion of a recent study that examined condom negotiation in men and women ages 18 to 25. The researchers found that heterosexual men, heterosexual women, and men who have sex with men all use different strategies when negotiating condom use with a new partner. Straight men tend to be more willing to have sex without a condom, while women may withhold sex if their partner refuses to use one, and men who have sex with men aim for a balance between these approaches. Why don't they just say homosexual men?
Yeah.
That's really weird. Okay. The study found that heterosexual women might be more willing to take risks when they have stronger relationship motivation and view their partner as having more relationship potential. We've spoke about this in the past. A fair number of younger men report experiencing erectile dysfunction when they use condoms, which they say affects sensation. But is this phenomenon actually caused by condoms? Condom use often produces its own kind of performance anxiety in men who begin to worry about losing feeling and maintaining their erection, clinical sexologist Lawrence Siegel explained. But it's not the condom. It's the discomfort with their use and the distraction that the discomfort produces. What do we think?
Yeah, I've seen some firsthand experience with this.
Of which part?
As soon as the condom goes on and, you know,
It does happen.
It all goes limp.
It does happen. Yeah, see, in the chat room, someone just said, condoms give me super ED, erectile dysfunction. Yeah, a lot. But you're using good condoms. You got to be using skin, my friend.
Use good condoms and masturbate with condoms. Yes. Get used to it.
Yes, and lower the grip
on
the masturbation, too. You don't want to masturbate yourself.
Use lube.
Use lube
when
masturbating. Exactly. Put lube in the condom, and it's going to feel great.
Just make sure.
Lube in the condom, and then put it on the penis. It feels amazing.
Make sure you're using the right lube.
Yes.
Water-based.
Good lube, Amazon. Go find it.
Oh, we need our Amazon affiliate link.
We need an Amazon affiliate link for our lube. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, use condoms, guys.
Inverse study. The top four drugs that enhance sex indicate why people use them. Methods. I'm just going to read from the methods of the study. It was right here. Up somewhere. An international online self-selecting cross-sectional drug survey. The Global Drug Survey 2013 was conducted. Respondents were asked about which drugs, including alcohol, they had sex with while on, how frequently they used the drugs to enhance sex, and how different drugs change different aspects of the sexual experience. We report descriptive statistics and test differences between men and women and between different sexual orientations. Results, SLS, occurred across sexual orientations in both men and women. All groups reported that alcohol, cannabis, and MDMA were the most commonly used drugs with sex. Larger proportions of homosexual and bisexual men had sex while on most drugs than heterosexual men, and larger proportions of bisexual women had sex while on drugs more than heterosexual women. More than 20% of each group reported having used drugs with the intention of enhancing a sexual experience. Larger proportions of homosexual and bisexual men reported the behavior than heterosexual men. There were clear dissociations between the effects of different drugs on different aspects of sexual experience, although hydroxybutyric acid and something else I don't know how to say, and MDMA were rated consistently high.
Woo! I thought that was kind of funny.
What do we think about that?
It's funny. People like MDMA, aka ecstasy.
Interesting that the bisexual and homosexual people were more likely to try than heterosexual. The heterosexual people are just boring.
Yeah.
That's what it's coming down to. You guys are all boring.
That's also what I took away.
Yeah. Anyone who claims, apparently, you're all boring. Because you know what? If you have never mixed marijuana and sex, highly recommend it. Call me up, 509-878-3229. Let me know how it is. HealthyTalkShow.com. Where are we at? There we are. Inverse. Oh, stupid ad. Get out of here. Inverse study. MDMA reveals how it returns brain to a teenager critical period. Science Daily. Psychedelic drug MDMA may reawaken critical period in brain to help treat PTSD. MDMA seems to open up a critical period of social reward learning, a period of development when one learns that it feels good to be a member of a group. In adulthood, that critical period closes, which may be the reason PTSD treatment, which requires close social interaction with a therapist, is difficult and why it seems to work better when MDMA is involved. Dolan and her team studied groups of mice in enclosures with different bedding. They put several mice together in one enclosure with one type of bedding for 24 hours, and in the next 24 hours, put the same mice by themselves in another enclosure with different type of bedding. The mice began to associate certain types of bedding with isolation or companionship. Then they let the mice wander between enclosures with the two types of bedding and tracked how long the mice spent in each enclosure. The more time the mice spent in the bedding linked to their companions indicated more social reward learning. It's why people gather around the water cooler, they said in the experiments. Dolan and her colleagues found that the critical period for social reward learning in mice is around puberty and wanes once they become mature adults. To determine if they could reopen the critical period, and the scientists gave MDMA to mature mice, waited 48 hours for the drug to be washed out of their system, and observed how the mice explored their enclosures and behaved with other mice in the enclosure. Following the treatment with MDMA, most of the animals responded to social interactions the same way as juveniles, by forming a positive association between social interactions and the bedding. This effect lasted for at least 2 weeks after the MDMA treatment and was not observed in mice given saline injections.
That was really interesting.
It really, that one made me think.
Yeah.
The part where after puberty, we don't no longer want social interactions, or at least that's what the study is saying about mice. That's kind of weird.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
And then, you know, we hit puberty, we get on our phones, we get on Instagram, and we never have social interaction again. We never want it back. We never think about it.
Yeah. And then it's also the MDMA, the oxytocin trigger signaling that encodes learning and memory, which again is what the younger, what they saw in the younger mice or younger people, yep, and not seen in the mature mice. And they were also saying that the part of the social bonding that you mentioned, that also helped create a better psychotherapist-patient bond, which was also critical for treatment, especially for PTSD. So pretty interesting.
Very good.
I really like that they're exploring alternatives.
Yes. And how do we get involved in this research?
Sign me up.
PhD.
Ask a healthy doctor.
PhD. don't no look at Robert. I can be a test subject. That's about all I'm qualified for. All right. Ready?
Yep.
CNN, Senator's scathing letter to Jewel demands answers about tactics targeting youth ties to big tobacco. 11 senators sent a letter on Monday, April 8th, demanding answers from Juul Labs, whose business practices have been shrouded in immense secrecy. They are requesting data plans and other information from Juul related to its popularity among youth and its relationship with tobacco giant Altria, which invested nearly $13 billion in the company last year. The senators are pressing Juul for detailed information on its sales and ad spending, how the company plans to keep underage people from seeing its ads or buying its products, new business dealings that emerged after the Altria announcement, how the company plans to verify ages and prevent people from ordering in bulk online, and what financial ties the company has to the conservative-leaning and anti-regulation organizations that wrote to President Trump in February hoping to hamper the FDA's crackdown. The lawmakers requested a complete list of social media influencers paid by Juul to publicize its brand. Wow. I like the Trump thing. In the middle of the thing, it's... Oh yeah, we want to know about what you're doing.
Yeah, you I was kind of surprised that people were coming down on this. Yes, actually.
And actually, CNN ran a piece on an Instagram influencer, so let's take a look at how much they were paid. So we're gonna go to that right now.
We captured some photos.
This is Christina Zayas at work.
Added some lifestyle of me.
For the last 10 years, she's made her living as a blogger and social media influencer. One of her recent jobs: post positive content about the e-cigarette Juul.
They really wanted to appeal to the younger market, and they did.
Juul had hired an influencer marketing firm, which then reached out to the then 35-year-old Christina in September of 2017, hoping to target her 57,000 Instagram followers.
If you are a smoker, then please let me know your interest in a collaboration with Juul.
Christina shared that 5% of her followers are in the 13 to 17 age range.
She knows her followers' demographic.
Yeah.
And she's just she's just saying, oh, here's their demo. Yep, here we go. I'm an influencer.
They're especially susceptible to being influenced, according to Stanford researcher Dr. Robert Jackler, who's been following Juul since early marketing campaigns more than 3 years ago.
Ooh, they're getting aggressive with their marketing.
Also, that just shows you how they use the Instagram as just more marketing. It's always advertising.
Yep. What's the budget, CNN?
They advertise exactly where young people live. Young people today are on social media. They're on their phones continuously throughout the day looking at social media channels.
Juul's team reached out to me to work together. We came up with working on a sponsored post, which is just a blog post, and then one Instagram post. Their budget was, okay, we can offer you $1,000.
Juul declined an on-camera interview, but conceded. It paid fewer than 10 influencers who are all smokers or former smokers, and collectively paid less than $10,000.
The total compensation was less than $10,000.
All that's telling me is they did not pay them enough.
I know, they underpaid them.
You guys are getting ripped off.
They advertised exactly...
Oops, did not mean to do that. And then I have one more closing out the clip, but yeah, let's do it.
I think it's incumbent also upon the companies that are marketing these products to also take steps to try to crack down on the youth use.
FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb's concern is that teens are not aware that many e-cigs contain high levels of nicotine, which is addictive, particularly harmful to the developing brain, and more likely to lead to traditional cigarette use.
You know, the FDA sees thousands of documents from e-cigarette maker Juul.
Since the FDA cracked down on Juul this fall, the company says it ended its social media campaign in the United States. Dr. Jackler says, too little, too late.
Turning off Juul's own contribution to this at this point doesn't matter because it's become a fad and it's taken on a life of its own.
I don't disagree.
That's true.
Yeah. Just a few points from that really quick. Unless you have a point.
No, go for it.
You don't? Okay. A few points. Well, the Instagram influencer part, I cut out the part where she said, I feel bad about what I'm doing. Now I'm trying to, you know what? You're on CNN. I'm sure they paid you too. Think about it. She just wants more attention. That's probably,
Well, and then it starts spreading on the social media because now it's cool to vape. So now more people.
And it looks like CNN might just be after some of that advertising money. What do you think, guys? Their biggest advertisers are, you know, okay. I'm not going to say anything else. Be good. Be good about it. Oh, man. CNN, FDA investigates reports of seizures after vaping. USA Today, FDA, dozens of seizures reported after vaping, mostly by young people. And I actually have more video for this.
Jeez.
A lot of vape video this week.
The Food and Drug Administration announcing they will investigate a possible link between vaping and seizures. This after the FDA revealed since 2010, they've received 35 reports of seizures among teenagers using e-cigarettes. The FDA writing, "We have reports indicating that some people who use e-cigarettes, especially youth and young adults, are experiencing seizures following their use." The FDA's announcement increasing scrutiny on the booming industry. One e-cigarette company saying in part, "They will vigilantly monitor for any evidence of safety issues and work cooperatively with FDA as we continue to combat youth usage."
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're combating.
According to the CDC, 3.5 million middle school and high school students reported vaping in 2018.
Wow.
More than 10 times the number of...
3.5 million reported vaping?
That's crazy.
Whoa. ...teen users in 2011. Just last year, the FDA limited the sales of flavored products to try to keep them out of the hands of teenagers.
Is that working? I see a lot of teenagers vaping still.
Yeah, I don't think it's working.
What is the FDA asking people to do?
This amounts to the FDA doing like a call out. Hey, tell us if you have a problem. And is that unusual for it to do?
It is unusual for them to do, especially do it in this public of a forum here. And what they're saying is we want more reports on this. If this has happened to you, please contact us. They developed a safety portal you can go to. Today.com, there's a story about vaping. We put the safety portal link in there so you can go ahead and go to it if you've experienced any of this, because they think this is just the tip of the iceberg. They think there's more people out there having these issues, just haven't reported them.
Well,
they're asking people to report them.
I have some theories over what might be going on.
Okay. So, well, hold on. Can I play a clip?
Oh, sorry. I didn't know you had one more clip.
Addressing the chat room, cigarettes are a good alternative to vaping? Well,
yes.
I've got a number of friends who contend this, that vaping, it's safer than traditional cigarettes. It's not nearly as bad.
And the way we talk about it is if you're a chronic smoker, then vaping is safer than smoking those cigarettes as much as you do. But that does not mean that vaping is safe. And we're finding out more and more things like this connection are possibly there, the seizures. Also, when you vape, you're getting chemicals in your body that you don't know about. Formaldehyde, acetaldehyde. You're getting all these different chemicals into your body. And vaping, they have another name for them, ENDS, E-N-D-S, electronic nicotine delivery systems.
Electronic nicotine delivery systems.
So they're delivering this high dose of nicotine. Yeah. That's where they think the connection might be with the
How much more nicotine are we talking about?
It's a lot more nicotine. With cigarettes, it's virtually impossible to overdose on nicotine. With these e-cigarettes, it seems like you possibly could at a point, and that's what the big concern is, especially, again, in the young, the teens, and
that's
the young adults.
That's nuts. Because that's true. With these modded rigs or whatever you want to call them, you can, and these cartridges, you can pump them up to whatever you want.
Yeah. So he didn't go into numbers, but
no,
I'll go into numbers. So a cigarette is about 2 mg of nicotine. And then the problem with these vapes is some of them are going up to 40 mg in a cartridge. So if you smoke the whole thing, that's not good. And so I was trying to find what the LD50 of nicotine was. And unfortunately, it's actually not well studied. So for some reason, people say that the lethal dose is 60 mg. Mm-hmm. So again, they're putting 40 mg. And for some reason, they do say it's 60 mg. But there are actually contradictory studies that say it might be closer to 500 mg. But again, it kind of depends on the person.
Yeah.
But there, another thing that I found was that people were studying some nicotine and they experienced seizures. A few of these experimenters, this was an old experiment done a long time ago.
And we were experiencing seizures back then?
Yes.
Oh,
because
my.
Of overdosing of nicotine. Unfortunately, because the study's really old, their measurements are probably not accurate because they said they only had 1 to 4 mg, but that's probably too low.
That's really funny.
But again, this isn't the first time that nicotine has been shown to cause seizures, especially when we're talking high amounts.
Shh, don't talk about that. Remember Big Tobacco said they were going to send us a check? Remember?
Yeah, right.
So they're going to send us a check. HealthyTalkShow.com.
So yes, cigarettes are safer. I would say so.
Well, from the chat, is Mary Jane better, Robert? Well, I would say that marijuana is the winner there. It's the healthier choice out of all. If the three, cigarettes, vaping, or just straight marijuana. Robert says, marijuana. CNN, FDA looks into regulating CBD in food, beverages, and more. The FDA announced Tuesday, April 2nd, that it will hold a public hearing next month to discuss developing a regulatory framework for the use of CBD in consumer products, including food and beverages. From the statement itself, today the FDA is announcing a number of important new steps and actions to advance our consideration of a framework for a lawful marketing of appropriate cannabis and cannabis-derived products under existing authorities. These new steps include a public hearing on May 31st, as well as a broader opportunity for written public comment for stakeholders to share their experiences and challenges with these products, including information and views related to the product safety. The formation of a high-level internal agency working group to explore potential pathways for dietary supplements and/or conventional foods containing CBD to be lawfully marketed, including a consideration of what statutory or regulatory changes might be needed and what the impact of such marketing would be on the public health. Updates to our webpage with answers to frequently asked questions on this topic to help members of the public understand how the FDA's requirements apply to these products. The issuance of multiple warning letters to companies marketing CBD products with egregious and unfounded claims that are aimed at vulnerable populations. Today, the FDA announced that it's issued warning letters in collaboration with the Federal Trade Commission to three companies, Advanced Spine and Pain LLC, Natura Pure LLC, and Pot Network Holdings, Inc. Pot Network Holdings, Inc. That's a good one. In response to their making unsubstantiated claims related to more than a dozen different products and spanning multiple product web pages, online stores, and social media websites. The companies use these online platforms to make unfounded, egregious claims about their products' ability to limit, treat, or cure cancer, neurodegenerative conditions, autoimmune diseases, opioid use disorder, and other serious diseases without sufficient evidence and legally required FDA approval. Claims by these companies include CBD successfully stopped cancer cells in multiple different cervical cancer varieties. CBD also decreased human glioma cell growth and invasion, thus suggesting a possible role of CBD as an anti-tumor agent. For Alzheimer's patients, CBD is one treatment option that slowly the progression of the disease. And you get the idea. Bunch of BS. We look forward to the FDA being more open and considering the medical benefits of cannabinoids and examining the research on the subject, said Director of Media, Morgan Fox. What's up?
I'm not sure how I feel about this one.
And I'm stuck in this cell. I can't get out of this cell. There we go. I'm out. I got out of the cell.
On one hand, you know, I don't want them to be making false claims.
Yes.
On the other, let it be free. You know, people should. Yeah. I just wish people could, you know, people should be trusted to make their own decisions and do their own research. That's how I always feel.
Pro-marijuana people need to calm down with the cure-all, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Just say, smoke it and see what it does for you.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to say, oh, yeah, it's going to cure cancer. It's going to do this, that, the other. I can tell you how it works for me, but it's going to work different for you. Yeah. I've seen some people not react friendly to marijuana.
That's true.
Me, it all affects me exactly the same. Ars Technica. FDA slams homeopaths for uncontrolled snake venom, germs, and kids' products. Very, very similar, but now we're committed to continue taking appropriate actions when we believe patients are being put at risk by products that contain potentially harmful ingredients or have significant quality issues, FDA Commissioner Scott Gelb said in a statement. By the way, he just retired. One of the companies, Red Mountain Incorporated, based in Florida, was found to lack all quality controls for its homeopathic products, said that to contain components of snake venom. Without an adequate QU quality unit, you'll lack the ability to ensure the safety, identity, strength, quality, and purity of your drug product, the agency wrote in a letter. The product in question is called Biovin. Red Mountain claims without documented evidence that it can treat rheumatoid arthritis, AIDS, hepatitis B, C, some cancers, and lupus by reversing the body's chemical and immunological imbalances.
Woo! Yeah. Again, do your own homework, guys. Don't believe everything you read online.
Please.
That's all I have to say.
Please. Sticking with the FDA today. Okay. FDA proposes new fluoride standard for bottled water, but some say it's still too damn high. Oh, still too high.
Oh, my gosh.
The rent's too damn high. The FDA has proposed lowering the allowable level of fluoride in bottled water to 0.7 milligrams per liter. It's slightly lower than the currently allowed 0.8 milligrams per liter. Some health officials say the proposed limit should be even lower, citing studies that have found excess fluoride to cause bone disease and neurological issues. Given that fluoride can damage brain development, I would recommend the maximum fluoride concentration of bottled water to be kept at a lower level than 0.7 milligrams per liter, Dr. Philip Grandjean, an adjunct professor of environmental health at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, wrote in an email. Christopher Neuwirth, research director of the American Environmental Health Studies Project, which is connected to the Fluoride Action Network, an environmental advocacy group, said currently there are rapidly increasing scientific studies showing neurotoxicity to fluoride, with research showing a direct link between children's IQ and their level of fluoride exposure in the womb. That is our largest concern. Fluoride Action Network. The second you type in fluoride to Google, you get Fluoride Action Network.
Yeah.
And they are against fluoride in drinking water. Not just bottled water, in drinking water. They are against fluoride. So what are we going to do? What are we doing? What do we have to say about this fluoride?
Well, I have a lot to say about this topic.
Well, what does Europe do? Out of the population of about 750 million, under 14 million people, approximately 2% in Europe receive artificially fluoridated water. Those people are in the UK, 5.8 million, Republic of Ireland, 3.25 million, Spain, 4.25 million, and Serbia, 300,000. Huh, so why do we do it here in the States?
Yeah.
Why is it such a hot-button issue? What do we got?
Well, you can flip over to my screen. So these are countries that do add fluoride to their water. And so, you know, one argument for adding fluoride to the water is this kind of trend here where you see that tooth decay is decreasing over time. But the problem is you also see this in countries that do not fluoridate their water.
Oh, that's convenient or
interesting.
Yes.
And so a lot of people say that why this is happening is not because of fluoride in the water, but actually better access to healthcare or actually fluoride in toothpaste. Yeah. So we have to think about the two different ways we get fluoride. Because fluoride topically is okay. That's been proven, you know, fluoride in your toothpaste. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then the question is, why are we ingesting it? And that's really not answered.
Yeah, because ideally the best application would be topical, correct? Not drink,
correct.
Not passing, but more application.
Yeah.
So why are we drinking fluoridated water?
And then, so there's another thing too. So we posted a link for this. You can check it out. It's Fluoride in Drinking Water, a scientific review of EPA standards. And I'll just try to sum up some of the points. So some of what you mentioned is that fluoride over time, potentially it weakens bones. So initially they actually thought this was a cure for osteoporosis, which is kind of funny because they thought that it was increasing bone density, which it does seem to do.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, this actually makes the bones more brittle.
Yeah.
And so another problem with fluorine is really small, so it can kind of get everywhere inside of your system. So once it's there, it's, you know, hard to get out. It could also cause issues with your thyroid. So fluorine can displace iodine, which they're both halogens, so the same row in the periodic table. Another kind of theme that we've mentioned on this show is dosage makes a poison.
Yes.
And the problem with dosage is people drink different amounts of water.
Yes. For instance, I drink 6 to 10 liters of water a day. So I'm getting different fluoride exposure than someone that drinks 6 cups of water a day.
Yeah. And so the EPA actually mentions people like yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd be in the category of high water consumers. And you're potentially getting up to, I think it was four milligrams of fluorine in your water. And that's now over the recommended daily dosage.
Oh, crap.
Yeah.
Good thing I take all the fluoride oil. As much of it as I can out of my water.
Yeah.
Woo!
Robert's already paranoid about this.
Yes.
So.
Well, just because I drink so much water, I want to make sure what I'm drinking is going to be good and not have adverse effects.
It turns out you do have reason to be worried over these long-term effects.
Yes. Interesting. From the chat, if it caused brain damage, I'd expect to see some major differences in IQ between Europe and America. Well, I'm going to leave that one there because I don't know.
I think there are studies that have at least shown it. We'd probably have to look at more studies to see.
Yeah. That's a tough one. I don't know if it would affect the brain. I don't know. Well, you know, a lot of conspiratorial people that I know who write in the conspiratorial crowds, you know, people that I've spoken to, they say in the past that governments have used water, they shoot fluoride into a little village's water supply just so they can get into the village and no one's going to know what's going on because their brains are all messed up. That's just what I've heard. Again, conspiratorial stuff, unfounded, healthy talk show. I'm just giving all perspectives here, trying to be as fair as possible.
Yeah. I mean, it's all about dosage, too. And another thing that they mentioned, too, is we really are not sure what the long-term consequences are for being exposed to this water over a lifetime.
We won't. We are not going to know. All I know is Europe's not doing it.
Yeah.
So what would Europe do?
Well, there's been lots of studies showing that it's not that beneficial.
Moving on. All right. CBS 17. Measles count in U.S. this year already more than all of 2018. Let's take a look.
Doctors are now dealing with the second greatest number of measles cases reported since the infectious disease was officially eliminated nearly two decades ago. According to the CDC, 387 individual cases have been confirmed in 15 states from January to March 28th of this year. The CDC says one dose of the MMR vaccine is 93% effective at preventing measles. Two doses, about 97% effective.
That goes against what I was always told. Thank you very much. 93% effective, one dose. When did that change?
Now we have to get two doses?
Yeah. When did that change? Well, now, New York Times. Scientists thought they had measles cornered. They were wrong. Kaiser Health News. Why measles hits so hard within New York Orthodox Jewish community. This was kind of interesting. Because I've been hearing whispers about this. Measles cases in New York have been concentrated among children in Orthodox Jewish families, many of whom attend religious schools where vaccination rates may have been below the 95% threshold considered necessary to maintain immunity. The outbreaks began when unvaccinated travelers returned from Israel, where an outbreak persists and spread the disease here. Israel's measles outbreak began in March 2018 in a small Orthodox community in Tzfat in North, said Dr. Patrick M. O'Connor, leader of the Rapid Disease Control Team at the WHO's European office who oversees Israel. Although some Orthodox Jews claim that vaccinations are against Jewish law, that's not correct, said Dr. Aaron Glatt, who is also a rabbi and chairman of the Department of Medicine at South Nazu Communities Hospital in Long Island. There's not a single opinion that says vaccination is against Jewish law, he said. The clinics offering vaccines were not open on convenient days or couldn't accommodate big groups. Orthodox families may include up to a dozen children, and ensuring that all of them had two measles shots on schedule can be difficult. To comply with Israel's health ministry schedule, a child needs 9 doctor's appointments before age 6 to be fully vaccinated against 14 diseases. Children get measles shots at age 1 and 6. Vaccination rates among the Orthodox in Israel were in the 80% range, higher than many other countries, but not enough to stop the measles. Another contributing factor, even if they are sick, children are often brought to Orthodox weddings or other gatherings. The public may have grown complacent before the vaccine program began in the United States in 1963, as many as 4 million people became infected every year. Nearly 50,000 were hospitalized, and up to 500 people died annually. By the year 2000, measles was a disease that public health officials said was essentially eradicated in the U.S. thanks to a comprehensive vaccine program that reduced the number of cases by 99%. Damn.
Dang, that's great work.
Things pop up. Jeez. What do we got?
Why is everyone so crazy about measles, though?
I don't know. Are you queuing that clip?
Yeah, all right. I am. What do we do before?
We are queuing a clip from the Brady Bunch.
Before it was eradicated.
Let's take a look.
How do we survive?
And I have a follow-up.
Hi. Peter. What are you doing home from school?
They sent me home. Measles.
That's either measles or a strange case of red freckles.
You have got a temperature.
They told me 101.1. What's the record?
Never mind.
Oh, are you sure it's the measles?
Well, he certainly got all the symptoms. A slight temperature, a lot of dots, and a great big smile.
A great big smile?
No school for a few days.
Say hello to my dotted son for me. Tell him I'll bring him some comic books, and I'll see you later, dear.
Okay, honey, bye.
Boy, this is the life, isn't it?
Yeah. If you have to get sick, you sure can't beat the measles.
That's right. No medicine.
Inside or out. Like shots, I mean.
Don't even mention shots. Yeah.
Measles, measles, measles. Well, all the kids have now had the measles.
So have I.
Well, I had them years ago. Looks like the Bradys are finished with the measles.
Hold it.
Uh-oh. No, everybody has the measles.
You're not through yet.
My crumb.
Oh, man.
But fatherly, because someone responded to this. This was taken a little out of context. Let's read. The legendary anti-vaccine 13th episode of the Brady Bunch is real hilarious. In 1969, all children got measles on the 13th episode of the Brady Bunch. Today, that poorly ran B-plot is considered seminal by poorly informed activists. The plot of the episode isn't about measles at all. The primary conflict is about whether a pediatrician who is a woman can take care of the boys, if a pediatrician who is a man can take care of the girls. Meanwhile, the measles subplot, it really is a subplot, hilariously culminates in a giant chalkboard charting which Brady child has which symptoms, ranging from fevers to mumps to scarlet fever. This is all treated very lightly in the episode. At no point does anyone come and say the Brady kids could all die. Mom and dad are way too busy making jokes and accidentally calling two doctors to make a house call instead of one. Their marriage is clearly crap. Good editorial there, writer. The Bradys do not discuss vaccination at any point. They are not against it. They just act as though it's not an option. Okay?
Boy, this is the life, isn't it?
Yeah. If you have to get sick, you sure can't beat the measles.
That's right. No medicine. Inside or out. Like shots, I mean.
Don't even...
Like shots, I mean.
Mention yeah. Shots.
They don't like shots. I don't... Yeah. Maybe they were anti-vaccine. Maybe because it was new and they were...
Yeah, but why is there so much worry over measles?
I have no idea. Because from Wikipedia, you can estimate 0.3% chance of dying from measles. And you have to think these might be in places without adequate access to healthcare.
You know? Yeah.
So
That's really interesting.
I don't know why the scare is... Why it's so hyped up.
Yeah, that's what bothers me.
That's why we're not really... We don't talk about it too much because it's kind... The Brady Bunch was woke, according to the chat.
Yeah. I mean, we're supposed to be vaccinated. I was looking at a map, mm-hmm. too, that said, you know, 95% of people are in compliance. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and that was all red.
Yeah.
And the map made it look like we're all going to die. It was really funny.
It was really weird. But
you had to do a double take.
So, I don't know. I don't think there should be so much fear-mongering, which is what's kind of going on now.
Yep.
If there's one case of measles, now we're all going to die type thing.
I don't think that's going to happen. I think there are enough of us vaccinated that we're... Well, that's kind of the point.
Yeah.
Are we ready?
Yep.
Thanks for tuning in. If you found value and useful information in this show, please support the show by emailing us ask@healthytalkshow.com, leaving us a voicemail 509-878-3229, or supporting us financially over at healthytalkshow.com/support. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks again. Love and light.
Love and light.
All right. Now I'm not going to click stop streaming. I'm going to click stop recording. Oh, thanks, Custom Mods. Hey, can you see the thing pop up on the screen? Did you see that?
Oh, I did.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And that's in our video now. That's in our video. So he made it. Good job.